Hello, everybody. I'm Philip Shaw. I'm Chief Economist at Investec here in London. Warm welcome to you for from our latest Investec Economics webcast. Of course, the coronavirus has been at the epicenter of market thinking all year, and that's certainly the case at present. If you look at the number of cases worldwide, they appear to have broadly leveled out. The number of European infections, however, has risen, and that includes the UK more recently, where things have risen sharply. How significant is this? Does it have major implications in terms of new COVID restrictions and therefore the economy? Are we getting any nearer to a functioning vaccine? Well, to answer those and other questions, I'm delighted to welcome back Michael Barrett, who is Professor of Biochemical Parasitology at the University of Glasgow's Institute of Infection, Immunity and Inflammation. Those of you who dialed in previously will undoubtedly remember that he spoke to us back in both February and May. Good morning, Mike. I hope you're keeping well.
Morning, Phil. Yes, very well, thank you. And I'm very pleased to be back. And always great to hear what's happening economically as well as from the public health perspective that we keep an eye on.
Okay, this morning's agenda is that I'll give you an update on the economy, and I'll also focus a little bit on the rumours of tax hikes that we heard recently before passing over to our guest. Afterwards, of course, we'll have the opportunity for Q&A. We've actually allowed up to an hour for the session this time, so it will run a little longer than usual. Just to make sure things run as smoothly as possible, could I make a few housekeeping points? Firstly, that all attendees are automatically on mute. Second, that in the Q&A session towards the end, please do ask a question. And to submit a question, same format as usual, please use the Q&A feature on the right-hand side of your screens and type your question, select Ask All Panelists to submit it. Number three, if you've got any problems with your audio, please do let us know by typing into the Q&A section, and our AV team will get in touch with you. And fourthly, if we are recording this session and our comments do not constitute investment advice. And last, if you're new to these sessions, at the end you'll see a screen inviting you to sign up for future updates. So, to kick off, let's make a few points on the economy. On the economic data themselves, the specific numbers do shift moderately from month to month in terms of our forecast. But looking in terms of the broad shape, our assessment of the domestic economy really remains the same as it has done. And you know, I hesitate to say that we're in a sweet spot, but we're very much still at a stage in the recovery phase where the official activity data and the survey evidence are still robust. And that's, of course, largely due to the unwinding of the various COVID restrictions. A lot of attention is on the quarterly GDP numbers. And as you might remember, the economy contracted by pretty grotty, it must be said, 20.4% in the second quarter of this year on the quarter. But remember, in the UK, we get monthly GDP figures. And what they're showing is a rebound in activity from May. And actually, on Friday, what we get is July's GDP numbers. And to give you an idea of the scale of things, our forecast for July is that the economy grew by 9.8% month on month. And that's after 8.7% in June. So if you look at things from the perspective of the pre-financial crisis times, that's about 7 years worth of growth, not 2 months. Now, that's in the context of the economy, of course, having shrunk by around 25% in 2 months, actually, in both March and April. One question is, when do these rapid rates of growth stop? And we think the answer is relatively soon. There are quite a few reasons why, but I'll just pick out three. Number one is that there aren't that many parts of the economy left to unlock. If anything, as well, the direction of travel right at the moment is to impose modest restrictions and local restrictions as well, especially bearing in mind that new reported cases in the UK have exceeded 8,000 over the past 3 days. Second reason is that pent-up demand will dry up at some stage soon. If you look at retail sales levels, they're actually running above a year ago, and that's despite fewer people in work and incomes falling as well. So that's really a temporary boost to the economy. And the third reason, of course, is that government measures and fiscal support generally are going to be wound down. Now, if you take, you know, one example, Eat Out to Help Out scheme, extremely popular, and a bit of anecdotal evidence here. I queued on a Monday night to get into my local Wagamama for over an hour. Now that's finished. And if you look at data from Open Table, it shows seated diners 75% down on a year ago. And that's perhaps an example of, you know, what sort of support government measures have been lending the economy. More critically, it's going to be one of the key issues is going to be how many furloughed workers return to work when the CJRS program ends at the end of October. In terms of peak furloughed numbers, that was just under 9 million. Official data for the end of June show 6.8 million jobs being furloughed. I've seen recent estimates that that might be 4 million towards the end of August. I think in terms of unemployment, yes, it will rise. Lots of stories saying it will reach 3 million from 1.3 million now. Actually, our own view is that, that's probably excessive. We can't be sure. But what we think is that we'll see, you know, quite a rise in unemployment, a drop in disposable incomes, and that will slow spending down. Having said that, a double-dip recession or a W-shaped recovery is not our baseline case. Yes, we are looking for a marked slowdown from the summer's figures, but and we do judge the risks to be to the downside from our forecast. But we are factoring in from the middle of next year a gentle acceleration in GDP, and that's partly on the premise that we get a vaccine in the UK at some point early in 2021, which precludes the need for so much social distancing and improves confidence. And here, you know, news such as the AstraZeneca trials overnight are going to be critical, and I'll look forward to Mike's views on that. Just say a few words on tax. And, you know, as we've discussed before, looking at the fiscal metrics, either in the UK or elsewhere in the world, it's not a pretty picture at the moment. And here we're facing a deficit well in excess, we think, of 300 billion in this financial year. If you look at the amount of outstanding government debt in the economy, that already excludes £2 trillion, although that is distorted by various factors, such as the amount of quantitative easing. Now, against that background, what we had a week and a half ago was the Sunday press carrying stories that the Chancellor is planning tax increases at the autumn budget. And specifically, they were suggesting three areas where revenue would be clawed back. The first one was a 5p rise in mainstream corporation tax rate from the current rate of 19p. The second was an equalisation of capital gains tax and income tax rates. And the third one was the further restriction of tax relief on pension contributions. So let's just look at one of those in turn, each of those in turn, to see how realistic they are. The first one, corporate taxation. I think what Sunak will try and do is to say, look, the government has already helped out companies significantly, and a clawback is justified. And he'll also say, look, a 24p rate or so is not out of line with the European average. The second on capital gains tax, that really isn't a Conservative Party thing to do, is it really? But don't forget, that's exactly what George Osborne did in 2010. So there is a precedent there. And the third on pension tax relief, again, restricting that isn't what you'd imagine that the Tories support. And the government, of course, has been trying to encourage pension saving. But yes, it's very true that restrictions have been phased in over recent years. And again, that is another precedent. It's important to remember who the government's main target is electorally these days. And that's very much to hold on to the red wall seats in the Midlands, Northern England and Wales, in, you know, formerly diehard Labour areas. And the government really needs to build up infrastructure there, and it can't cut spending. And those three policies that were mentioned at least tick that specific political box. Another factor as well is, don't forget, this is no ordinary Conservative government. The cabinet has less influence on government policy than in a typical government. And the current style is very much more presidential than consensual. And Boris is certainly more willing to force through policies if he has to. But I think if you look at the macro environment, that's where the main challenge is. And really, in our view, it's not the time to force through fiscal tightening. There is a need 100% to address the fiscal position at some stage. And indeed, investors, markets, and the ratings agencies need some reassurance about the fiscal credibility and the medium-term path of the deficit and debt. So it's probably a good idea to provide that. What Sunak might do, we suspect, is to perhaps announce a token measure or two for the forthcoming fiscal year, and then announce deferred tax increases taking place later. And a good example of this was Ken Clark, when he had two budgets, I think one towards the end of 1993 and one in 1994. When he did exactly that, there was a major amount of fiscal tightening, primarily through taxation. Of course, thereafter, looking towards the medium term, the aim would be to cut taxes ahead of a 2024 election. And that is very much a conservative thing to do, and indeed other parties as well. But in the meantime, governments and, of course, ourselves and markets will be hoping for a few positive developments. I think, firstly, that the UK-EU trade talks begin to go a bit better. That could be a little bit ambitious over the next couple of days, bearing in mind that there's going to be a bill published in the UK today, which seems to contravene the EU withdrawal agreement, which of course is an international treaty. Personally, I suspect some of the allegations and the commentary has been overdone somewhat, and I'm happy to chat about that if anybody's interested. And secondly, major hope, of course, on the coronavirus-related issues, that the recent spike in UK infections is contained soon, that test and trace becomes more efficient over the winter season, and that a vaccine is developed sooner rather than later. So at this point, I think it's appropriate to hand over to our guest. In that respect, I'm delighted to hand over to Professor Michael Barrett, who I don't think wants to answer the Brexit question so much, but I'm sure he'll cover the COVID-related points and more. So, Mike, over to you.
Well, thanks, Phil, and hello, everybody. If anybody can't hear me properly, if you just message in, then I'll try to make sure that I can be heard clearly. So, as Phil mentioned, I first came along to Investec at the end of February, when Northern Italy was being hit and the UK was waiting. By the time I was here again in May, globally, we were well into the millions of cases, and the UK up to about a quarter of a million by that time. We were into the lockdown at that stage, and we saw the transmission within the UK declining very steadily over the period of the lockdown and beyond. And that ultimately enabled us to end the lockdown and enter into our current world, where we are still really experimenting with how we can live with the coronavirus. Many people ask me, did we need to have a lockdown? And I think normally, if you ask anybody from the public health world, they will tell you unambiguously that yes, we absolutely did. Because in reality, when we thought that a quarter of a million people were infected in May, the reality is we were 10, 20, even up to 50 times more than that with the numbers of people infected across the UK. We've learned a lot about the disease. We know that not all that many people who infected die. But we also know that older people and people with comorbidities do die. And unfortunately, by the time we did have the lockdown that started late in March, we were already completely out of control with the disease. Had we not locked everybody indoors, we really would have been running up into the hundreds of thousands of people dying across last summer, and many, many millions of people infected. So we did need the lockdown. We shouldn't, I think, need another lockdown, even if numbers do continue to rise, because I think our collective knowledge of how others across the globe have dealt with the disease mean that we really should be able to deal with it without a further lockdown. In terms of the interventions which are available to us, in reality, they can work. The lockdown actually did work. But if we look, for example, at Sweden, and I consider Sweden to be a very, very good model, Responsible social distancing without a lockdown has actually worked pretty well. It doesn't mean that nobody gets the disease. It doesn't mean that nobody has died in Sweden. And I think that they made a similar blunder to the UK in actually allowing the disease to run rife in care homes, which is where many of the Swedish and the British deaths have occurred from. But we do know that the disease is transmitted in droplets. They may be airborne. If you wear a mask, you will capture your own virus. Have you got it? And you're asymptomatic. And also, if you're wearing a mask, you're less likely to obtain somebody else's virus. A lot of the transmission, however, isn't directly through the airborne route. It's you will touch droplets that somebody else has deposited on a surface, and you will pick them up and you will introduce them to your own nostrils or mouth, hence the requirement for regular hand washing, and hence the requirement to make sure that there's great hygiene maintained everywhere. Here at the University of Glasgow, we're not at full occupancy by any means in our building, but we have somebody who comes around at least 3 or 4 times a day, wiping every single handle in our department. And we are all encouraged at all time to keep all of our surfaces cleansed, so get rid of any particles which are on there. The 2 meter rule: if you are breathing out a virus, gravity will take it to the ground if you're far enough away from the person to whom you are standing next to. And if we stay at home, then we know that we're not going to get the disease. So social distancing on its own can enable us to beat the disease in the short term, but in the long term too, because there is this critical number that we describe as the R naught number, the reproductive rate, the number of people who can obtain the virus from a pre-infected person. And R naught is not something which is intrinsic to the virus. It's a combination of something which is intrinsic to the virus and how societies behave. So when the outbreak occurred initially in Wuhan in China at the end of last year, that it looks as if the R naught value was around 3.5. And actually, that's where this herd immunity number comes from. Herd immunity is a standard epidemiological concept, and it can be expressed mathematically, where the percentage of the population which needs to have been infected in order that the virus can no longer find enough people to continue a transmission chain is 1 minus 1 divided by the R naught value. So if you've got an R naught of around 3, that means 1 minus 1 over 3 is around 66% of the population needs to be infected to get that herd immunity. If you practice different levels of social distancing, the R naught number goes down and down and down, which means that it is probable that under socially distanced circumstances, R naught may be 2 or 1.3 or something like that. And if it is around 1.3, then you're in a situation where your herd immunity would kick in at around 30%. And we are seeing large urban areas where probably 30% of the people have had it, and we are seeing less transmission in those areas whilst social distancing is being practiced. Stop practicing social distancing, the R naught's going to come up again, and your herd immunity bar will be reset. So very, very important. How do we know who has this disease? How do we know who has had it? Well, to find out who has had the disease, we have the antibody tests. What happens is if you get infected with the virus, you will make an immune response to it. Many people who make an immune response will get antibodies. We can then go and test your blood to see if you have made those antibodies, and that tells us if you have had the virus. Unfortunately, not everybody gets a seroconversion, and the reason we still don't have mass use of the antibody tests in the UK is that they're still not good enough to give you absolute sensitivity and specificity. They're good for epidemiological studies, but it's too dangerous for people to possibly get a false positive or false negative for them to be widely available to the public. The main test that we still use is one that I'm involved in implementing. I work in one of the so-called mega labs in Glasgow at the moment, the Lighthouse Lab, and we do PCR testing. Many of you probably have had this test. You will give a swab test where the swab is rather unpleasantly stuck to the back of your throat and the back of your nostrils, goes into a little tube. We then get those, we're processing them tens of thousands every day now, and ultimately we'll do a molecular test that says whether you've got viral nucleic acids, yes or no. And that is really the basis of the track and trace system. And the UK is doing more tests than anybody else in Europe. We're doing huge numbers of tests. We're doing far more tests than they do in South Korea. And South Korea really sort of led the way with track and trace. And they did that because of previous viral outbreaks, such as the MERS outbreak in 2013, and also the SARS outbreak of 2003. They realized that if you catch people with a respiratory virus, put them inside, they can't transmit it to other people. South Korea is doing 10 to 20,000 tests a day. We're doing up to 200,000. What we're not doing well enough is the contact tracing and the vigorous policing of the isolation of people. I still think that too many people are not letting everybody know who their contacts are, and we don't have a system as robust as the South Koreans to make sure that contacts stay inside. And I think that's something that the government really is going to have to look at if we do see numbers continuing to increase in the UK. We've learned a bit about the immunity over the last 6 months. We do know that if you are infected, you will develop an immune response. For the most part, it seems that that immune response is robust, although you will have heard that reinfections are beginning to pop up all around the place. But I think one has to just accept that that's going to be the case. You don't have an absolute strong immunity. That's normal for coronaviruses. But I think if you have been infected, you're going to have enough immunity not to get badly sick again. And immunity, of course, is not just the antibody response. Some people will manifest purely what we call a T cell response, which is another way that we commonly deal with viruses. And because we know that individuals infected are creating a reasonably good immune response, we can be happy that herd immunity will work in the way that we anticipated it should work. But again, I go back to my previous comments on the importance of the R naught value as to where that bar is set for herd immunity to kick in. So we do know that we can combat this virus from purely social means. We have also made some advances in therapy. The only antiviral that's made it so far is still remdesivir. That's a little bit disappointing because remdesivir is an injectable. You can only give it to people when they're in hospital, so it's only being given to people with serious disease. Efforts are going on to find an orally available drug which could be much more readily administered to people, even with mild disease or in the early stages of the disease before they're hospitalized, but we haven't got there yet. The other big advance in therapy has been through the anti-inflammatories, and I think last time I was speaking about some relatively expensive drugs, some monoclonal antibodies, which are aiming to dampen what we call the cytokine storm that some people get in their over exuberant response to the virus. It was looking good that some of those drugs work, but they're very expensive. And then dexamethasone turned up, a cheap steroidal anti-inflammatory, and does just as good a job. And other steroids are coming around now, and these are cutting the death rates by at least 30% for those people who get into hospital very, very ill. The convalescent serum has had some success. This is antibodies which somebody who's been infected has made, can be purified, and then given to somebody who's been infected but hasn't had time to make their own antibodies. There's a bit of controversy over those, not because it doesn't work, perhaps doesn't work as well as we hoped it might do, but it does give some effect. But the problem has been that nobody had actually done the right kind of large, double-blinded, randomized clinical trial, which meant that it was very difficult to really be sure of the data that was available as to whether it was working or not. But notwithstanding, I think that the drug efforts have been fairly good for the amount of time that we've been working on this, and I do anticipate that we will continue to get new therapies which will be useful against the drug. As Phil mentioned, really a lot of the world's hope is resting not on drugs which can cure people once they've been infected, but can we get a vaccine that will prevent us from getting the disease in the first place? And I think probably last time I was here, I was a little bit skeptical. And I was a bit skeptical because, as an infectious diseases researcher, I've seen many instances where you don't just get a vaccine. For malaria, for example, we've been trying to get vaccines for years and simply can't get them. We know that for HIV, we have not been able to get a vaccine. However, I think as we've begun to understand immunity to the coronavirus, and as the trials with different sorts of vaccines have been setting up, we are beginning to see that this may really offer the way out. We've been quicker in producing these vaccines than anything ever before, and that's partly because we had been working on new technologies specifically in order to combat something like COVID-19, which is caused by a fast transmitting respiratory virus. Some of the new technologies which have been put into place with DNA vaccines, RNA vaccines, or in the case of Oxford, the so-called adenovirus-vectored vaccine, have all enabled us to produce vaccines which will give us viral material against which we can mount an immune response without us ever having to see the actual virus itself. And in many of the trials which have been established, we have seen those immune responses, and we are now into phase three trials. You've probably heard about the Oxford AstraZeneca trial. Bad news this morning, but it's gone on to pause. But we shouldn't get too desperate about that. This vaccine's gone into tens of thousands of people in the UK. It's also being trialed in South Africa and Brazil, which is good news because the low numbers in the UK over the summer was making it very difficult to think we would reach the correct number to know whether it's working or not. It's been into tens of thousands of people. So the fact that this morning we've heard that there was an adverse event which hasn't been qualified in somebody actually is not necessarily a great surprise, and we shouldn't be too put off by that. You've probably heard about the Russian vaccine and subterfuge and Russians coming in and breaking into people's sort of computer accounts to find out what they're doing. I don't think that's necessarily the case. The Russian vaccine is similar but different to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. It's an adenovirus vectored vaccine, but they use a different adenovirus. And the group in Russia that's been doing this have been working on those kinds of vaccines for years. I think the issue with the Russia vaccine is that it's actually really running almost neck and neck with the Oxford vaccine. The difference is, however, that the Oxford vaccine is currently still under trials in a phase three trial to collect data and monitor people really closely, whereas the Russians have been talking about bypassing the phase three trial based on a few individuals who received the vaccine in a say in a phase two trial. They've decided that they may just go ahead and use it. There's a lot of discussion at the moment as to whether in the US as well, there may be a political imperative to try and get a vaccine into people before the completion of trials for political reasons. And I think that's going to be a debate that runs and runs and runs. However, I do think that we're going to get some success with the vaccines. We don't need to have complete sterilizing cure. What we need to do is to get enough of an antibody response into people who have taken the vaccine to mean that a fatal disease may become a serious disease, and a serious disease may become a mild disease, and a mild disease may become asymptomatic. So it's not necessarily looking for the sterile cure. It's really looking to see if we can diminish the impact of the virus in everybody. Also, getting some sterile cure in a good number of people, because that will also help us to achieve herd immunity. And we know we can achieve herd immunity under different levels of social distancing. But I think, again, as Phil mentioned earlier, we would like to get herd immunity with a level of social distancing that doesn't cripple the economy. We don't need to have a second shutdown. I'm sure of that. We can look across the world and we can look at ways where the virus has been pretty successfully dealt with. New Zealand shut their borders. They're getting dozens or so cases again now, but they can control it. South Korea, track and testing and tracing with pretty rigorous quarantine works. Sweden, responsible social distancing. Yes, you get cases. Yes, you get deaths, but the rate of increase was much slower than it ever was here. And actually, without still having ever gone into a lockdown, in spite of the fact that Sweden kept seeing increasing numbers across the summer, they have started to decline again now. So I am relatively confident that we can deal with the coronavirus, and I hope that we can deal with it without having to take extreme social distancing measures again, instead using what I hope will be successful in terms of vaccines, but also public health measures, which will help us to calibrate the population level immunity. So I can probably stop there, because I'm sure it's going to be more interesting for people to ask questions that I may be able to answer, and get to some specific queries that people may have. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. That was absolutely fascinating, as always. We do have quite a few questions coming through, and we'll try and deal with as many as we can. First one that's come through is exactly how worried should we be in the UK that recorded cases have shot up so far recently? Is it just over 8,000 cases over the last 3 days? And that's bearing in mind that the UK, as you said, has ramped up testing, and that those being infected appear to be younger and at less risk of getting a serious case of the disease.
So the government, for sure, are very, very concerned. I'm not quite so concerned. I've anticipated that this would happen. I mean, first of all, not just within the UK, but even if you do as I do and gaze at some of the epidemiological curves that we see around the world, second wave. I mean, Spain had this huge takeoff. Very few people have died. France has been getting huge numbers coming in. The UK was always going to get that, because we do have a lot of people who haven't been infected. And as soon as the lockdown was released and social distancing became ever less prevalent, and frankly, the opening of the schools was going to have an impact. We may not yet have seen the opening of the schools impact. So there are two reasons why we're seeing this big increase in numbers. Number one is actually the amount that we're testing now. When we went back to March and April, we were testing really just in the order of thousands of people. Those people turning up at hospital, really sick, were being tested, and hey ho, they were a positive coronavirus test. But now we're doing nearly 200,000 tests per day. And one thing I've noticed since we worked in the Lighthouse lab, we started off in April. We were testing just NHS workers who were symptomatic. 25% of tests we did were positive. We then started doing key workers who were symptomatic. 10% were positive. We then went to the population as a whole who were symptomatic. We went down to 1%. We then got as low as about 0.1%. And we've just been watching it creep up again since then. So the absolute numbers are going up because of the increased testing, But I must say that what we have seen in the last month is a steady rise in the proportion of positives, which means we are getting a real increase in numbers, not just increases in testing. But then when we do look, we do find that most of those are young people. They are young people who are not social distancing. They're going into the pubs and the clubs and house parties. And that seems to be where most of the transmission is at the moment. And to the most part, but by no means all of the time, those young people will not get so sick they're going to die. Some will get very sick and have to bear that in mind. I do fear that we are going to see more transmission from this sort of newly infected young cohort into their parents' generation and their grandparents' generation. And I do think that we are going to see increased hospitalizations and increased deaths over the coming weeks. However, I do think the government is looking really hard. And I do think that with the testing that we have, our ability to implement local lockdowns to try to contain any major outbreaks, to stop people traveling from an outbreak area to other areas, should work. It should keep numbers low, but they will have to be enforced. We can do a Sweden. We must have responsible social distancing to slow the transmission of the disease. And then let's hope that that vaccine comes along whilst we're still containing the disease.
Okay, thanks very much, Mike. I hope you've got a glass of water with you because we've got quite a few questions for you to answer coming through. Second question is that is the view that we will not need another lockdown likely to be the same advice being given to politicians from their medical advisors? In other words, how consistent is the government's message with the advice coming through?
I think that they should be, well, I think they need to be ready to do another lockdown if we can't contain the rebound with the measures that are needed. But I don't think anybody in the scientific public health community would be asking for another national lockdown. At this stage, it's unnecessary, and it was going to remain unnecessary provided we can sustain the policies of enforced social distancing, local lockdowns, prevention of transmission. We have to shield really, really carefully the care homes, the elderly, in ways that we failed to do, frankly, earlier this year. But we know we need to do that. So my view is that really no public health official was going to ask for another lockdown, whilst we still have the opportunity to keep this thing at bay using sensible social distancing measures.
Okay, another question coming through is that is the government strategy to eliminate the disease, or is it to contain it? For example, to regulate the capacity of the NHS, or to get herd immunity, or is there something else? What is the government, do you think, ultimately aiming at?
I think the government would love to be able to eliminate the disease. And I think that they, as the billions they've invested in unproven vaccines tell us, is they could do it with the vaccine. Until then, I think we have to continue to play a containment game. We need to play the containment game through the proven methods of social distancing, which will minimize the spread of the disease. I don't think that herd immunity makes sense, because to rush herd immunity, you're going to kill lots and lots of people unnecessarily. A very clever device, which I don't think even the Swedes are using, could be a sort of a staged herd immunity. So I think, as I mentioned earlier, that where you do have social distancing mechanisms which prevent transmission, that you actually can stop. Or you can lower R naught in a way that means you reach herd immunity at lower levels, and then you might release social distancing a little bit. You put your herd immunity bar a little bit higher, and you sort of creep your way forward in that way. It could work. I don't think anybody's really thinking about that. It's containment.
Okay, next question coming up. We hear a lot about testing for antibodies. One questioner has asked, whether there is any established protocol for T-cell testing at scale?
Not really at scale. The problem with T-cell testing is that it's incredibly difficult. So antibodies, really, they're secreted by our B-cells. They're in our blood. We just need something against which those antibodies bind, and we can see them. T-cells, it's hugely complicated to purify people's T-cells, and then it's hugely complicated beyond then to see whether they are specifically reacting against the virus. So really, scale T-cell testing, no, not at this time.
Okay. I did warn you, Mike, that the questions are coming thick and fast. So, next one. Please clarify why the pandemic was handled differently in Sweden compared with the rest of Europe.
I think the Swedes just, I think, actually took a rather enlightened opinion that if they got in with social distancing early on, they could slow the progress of the epidemic quickly, and it worked. So I suspect that there were many debates within Sweden in the public health authorities, and they decided to go for the responsible social distancing, and my view is it's worked out for them. Could have gone the other way. Somebody had the debate and was better at arguing than somebody else.
Okay, another question coming through. Mike, could you please elaborate on the difference between aerosol and droplet transmission?
Yes, and it is quite important. WHO have recently acknowledged that aerosol transmission is possible. Essentially, aerosol means it can go from my mouth to your mouth or my mouth to your nostrils, i.e. is airborne. And that's because virus will be in very, very small droplets, which don't get taken down onto a surface as quickly by gravity as they do when they're in droplets. I think other than the acknowledgement that aerosol transmission is occurring, there was a feeling that most transmission was in droplets, i.e. you're more likely to get it by somebody's virus-filled droplet landing on a surface that you inadvertently then got onto your fingers and transmitted to your own mouth or nostrils that way.
Okay, someone is asking, in light of the increasing cases being proportionately higher in younger people, do you think that the restrictions announced this morning are suitably targeted?
Probably, primarily because it's, I think it's almost society is behaving in a society directed way. Young people generally don't think they're going to get the disease, so they're gathering together in big groups and trying to have kind of social lives that they were having prior to lockdowns beginning. Whereas I think those of us who are perhaps less cocksure that we're not going to get badly infected are less likely to get together in big groups anyway. So I think that actually limiting the size of gatherings in ways where you can have a responsible family life without having big parties is actually important at this time. And again, it goes back to this idea that the youngsters who may be gathering in big house parties and having fun may get infected, maybe asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic. But then go and infect their parents and grandparents and start a more lethal second wave of an epidemic that way.
Okay, the next question is to do with testing at airports, and I think that Grant Shapps was talking about this at the weekend, and that is that now a lot of airlines and airports are now conducting pre-travel or arrival tests. What is your opinion on the efficacy of those tests and procedures?
I think that I've still yet to be convinced on any of the rapid tests beyond the so-called RT-PCR test that's become the gold standard. Although people are trying to develop tests which can be performed quickly and give people a sort of 20-minute turnaround in an airport situation. My own view actually is that, again, it becomes a social and public health policy issue. Yes, if we can get reliable tests to give you a 20-minute result at the airport to do it there and then, but there's actually no reason why you wouldn't take samples from people arriving at an airport, put them through the tested gold standard PCR test, Make sure that you have contact details for those people. Make sure that they quarantine over the 24 hours it's going to take to get the answer, and then give them the results of that answer after the airport test. So I think it's feasible to test everybody as they come into the country. And there's always going to be arguments against it because actually the PCR test won't give you a positive if you only just become infected. So there's a risk that you get an airport test, you get a negative, you think that you're free, but then you get out into the community. So there's always going to be arguments against it, but I think airport testing, also, we're talking a lot at Glasgow University, should we test all of our students when they come back, in order to help us to guide isolation policies and diminish transmission within the university? It's all feasible, but we're going to have to continue to build that screening capacity in the UK. And actually, the screening capacity in the UK that has been built over the summer has been hit badly because as schools reopened, lots of children going back, all of them getting colds because they haven't been tested through the immunological system for the last 6 months, trying to get tests. So we do need to continue to build capacity.
Okay, Mike, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to have a glass of water. I'm going to answer a question, sort of, which has been directed to me. Do I think that capital gains tax will be equalised with income tax in one hit? Not sure if it'll be exactly equalised. What we might see is a hike in CGT approaching income tax levels, or perhaps at income tax levels with some reasonably generous allowances or exemptions. As I mentioned, the precedent for that under a Conservative, or actually technically a coalition government, was George Osborne in 2010 when he tightened up the rates. I can't remember specifically what they were. I think they were 28% and 20%. But one important factor here is that the HMRC has got a review into capital gains tax, which is probably signalling something there. The second point also is that not only did George Osborne raise capital gains taxes, he also cut them again in 2016. And I would imagine if the government does lift CGT in the next budget, then the plan will be to bring them down, of course, just before the next election. Okay, Mike, another question for you is that given the average age of death as specified from the ONS is 79, do you have an idea, or do you have a handle on what the terminal number of deaths would be in the UK if the disease was allowed to run unchecked?
If it were allowed to run unchecked, I actually think we would be running up probably into the sort of couple of 100,000 deaths directly attributable to COVID range. Not just because we'll just wipe out the elderly population, but we have seen that comorbidity population would suffer. People with underlying heart conditions, diabetes in particular, may be at risk. The other issue is that the healthcare worker problem, so it depends what uncontrolled means, but what we have seen in many countries is when we start having to deal with very sick people, have got massive viral loads, that's when healthy young healthcare workers will actually get a viral load that's sufficient to kill them as well. So, I can't imagine we would ever get to that situation again, but it would be hundreds of thousands of deaths in the UK, with no intervention.
Okay, got a very good question again here that might be a little bit more difficult to answer, but is there any further clarity on longer term health impacts for infected parties, even if it's asymptomatic?
Only that we know that it happens, and we don't know why it happens, and we don't yet know much about how to intervene, but we do even know that in infants who may be completely asymptomatic, they can get some late onset multi-organ inflammatory disease, which can be lethal. And we are seeing many people who have even had mild symptoms early on are getting long-term symptoms. One of my friends has didn't really have any symptoms other than a bit of breathlessness and loss of smell. They still haven't got their smell back. Another colleague of mine got moderately bad symptoms and is completely breathless from now on in. And we just don't really know what's happening pathologically that's causing these long-term symptoms, other than to know that they happen. And I think all of that points to us probably needing to look for new strategies to intervene in people, even without difficult symptoms, as early as possible, either with better antiviral drugs or even give people anti-inflammatories when they're demonstrating mild symptoms, because it is likely that some of those long-term problems are associated with inflammation in different organs, which is then sort of putting those organs into a suboptimal state for many months to come.
A couple of questions here on vaccines. When do you expect a vaccine to be available? If there is success in developing one, and how long do you think it would take to vaccinate 25 to 50% of the population?
Again, we're going to have to run into unprecedented sort of public health policies. I still can't see that we are going to have a vaccine ready before 2021. The data should start coming through, I think, from some of the vaccines under trials at the moment. And we may choose to fast track around some of the data analytics on those in order to get something first going into people later this year. But I think realistically, we're going to have to wait until early next year, into the springtime, before even the vaccines which are being trialed at the moment are ready. In very, I think, enlightened policy thinking, manufacture of these as yet proven vaccines is underway, and that's going to help us to start giving people the vaccines as quickly as we can once we're sure that they're happy. It would take a year for us to give 25 million people a vaccine under normal circumstances, but again, I'm seeing enlightened policies where government are training people to give vaccines. So I think if it works, we could see large numbers of population vaccinated by next spring.
Okay, thanks very much. I'm now going to take two or three questions at once on the economy. And they are, what's the source of the rumours for the changes regarding pension tax relief? What sort of changes might we see? And another one on the economy is that strong growth in GDP and following a sharp drop in March and April. What do we expect GDP growth to be this year? So, tackle these very quickly. We're expecting strong growth in August on the back of Friday's July figures, which we think will be very buoyant. And then still growth, but a slowdown in September and further into the fourth quarter of the year. Our full year GDP forecast is a drop of 8.4%. This year and a rebound of 6.6%. So I think with this year, that's a slightly on the optimistic end of the consensus there. On the pension tax relief, that came out in several newspaper reports about a week and a half ago. There have been some stories that higher rate relief would be completely scaled back to the basic rate. Another story suggests that we could actually see a standard rate, perhaps of 30%, or some sort of lifetime allowance-based system as well. It's not clear that this is happening, and there have been rumours about severe curtailment of pension relief before. But the direction of travel is, and certainly has been over the last 5 or more years, to reduce the reliefs on personal pension relief. One question again here for you, Mike. Are we seeing any evidence of rising deaths amongst the non-COVID infected population?
Marginal at this time, but I'm sure that once we begin to sort of deconvolute the noise, we will, and especially in chronic diseases like cancer and some chronic cardiovascular disease, primarily because the screening services have really not been operating at all or anywhere near full capacity over the last 6 months or so, which means that cancer in particular, problems which would have been picked up and diagnosed in time for an intervention will now be too late. So we definitely will see those. Conversely, we may see fewer issues around flu over the last year because the same social distancing measures which diminish the transmission of coronavirus will diminish the transmission of flu virus. So there may be a sort of unexpected, paradoxical, better health outcome for some respiratory viruses because of our response to coronavirus. But absolutely, we are going to see increased deaths from cancer and chronic cardiovascular disease because of the loss of testing over the last 6 months.
We've had, I think we're going into the last 2 or 3 minutes now, so I'll try and group a couple of questions together. And we've had a few questions on test and trace. Why has this not been effective so far? What do you think that the government can do to improve the efficacy of it?
I do think that we need to move to an electronic system that's documentable. I don't think we're seeing enough good contact tracing. I just think that people are still reluctant to, if I get diseased and I've been in contact with somebody, I wouldn't say me because I almost certainly would, but I think a lot of people would feel uncomfortable about putting their colleagues into isolation for 14 days just because they've been infected. So we need massive public training about the importance of this and more coercion through legislation to make it an offence not to contact trace if you're positive.
Okay, we're coming towards the end. So we've had a few questions re-education. So I'll try and group a couple of those together. And this unfortunately will be the last question. Do you think that schools will remain open over the winter? And secondly, how can you control the spread of the coronavirus given the reopening of universities?
I hope that schools will stay open, but it's because I think, but we've got to have a frank and honest discussion about that. We need schools to stay open because we need children to be educated. Children don't get ill, but they will bring virus home to infect their parents. That's where we need to intervene to try to minimize that happening. Some more social distancing at schools to keep them open and more rigorous isolation of children who are infected. At universities, we're going to see a lot of asymptomatic people getting the virus, carrying it around. But again, I think we just have to introduce those policies where universities are open, students in Glasgow, all of our lectures are going to be online. I hope the same is going to be true elsewhere, at least until the new year, and we should review it then. And we need students to behave responsibly. And sorry, I know an important part of the university experience is having fun, but I think people have to realize that those regulations of not getting too many people together are important for a reason, and it will go away. I think people just have to grin and bear it for another 6 months, and then they can go and party all they like.
Okay, that brings our latest webinar to a close. Thank you all very much for participating. I'm sorry if we didn't quite get to all the questions this time around. Thanks very much to Professor Michael Barrett for sharing his thoughts, his time, and I think I didn't quite count them, but I think you probably answered around 30 questions there, Mike. So thanks very much for dealing with a rapid fire. Looking ahead to what we're planning, we're looking at a politically oriented session. A webcast in 2 weeks' time. So watch out for the invitations there. And we hope to see you on the 23rd. Stay safe and thank you very much for attending.